This is the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. This show examines the latest legal topics and news facing families whose loved ones have been injured in a nursing home. It is hosted by lawyers Rob Schenck and Will Smith of Schenck Smith LLC, a personal injury law firm based in Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome to the show. Hey out there. Thank you for joining us once again. My name is Rob Schenck.
And I'm Will Smith.
And we are trial lawyers who practice in the areas of nursing home abuse and neglect law in the state of Georgia. We're coming to you from our offices in Atlanta, Georgia. Again, specifically in the library of our office, a.k.a. The Dungeon. This is a video podcast, meaning that you can catch us on a couple different ways. The first way is to watch this video podcast either on YouTube or our website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com, or you can download the audio version on Stitcher or iTunes, and all of those various ways to consume the podcast are available weekly on Monday mornings. Download for your listening pleasure. We're happy to be here. How are you, Will?
I'm doing well. We got a lot of interesting topics, so I'm looking forward to jumping right in.
Excellent. Okay, so we've been getting this question a lot lately. That's kind of the main topic that I want to address in this segment of the podcast, and that is, can someone go to jail for committing elder abuse, or can someone go to jail if they're a member of a nursing or a staff member of a nursing home and commit some type of abuse? And that what leads me to what I kind of want to talk about from a general standpoint, and that is, what is the difference between our civil justice system and our criminal justice system? Mm-hmm. What are the differences between those two things? And we, as in you and I, Will and I, we are trial lawyers representing individuals that have been injured in a nursing home. We take care of the civil component. Mm-hmm. Then there is a criminal component sometimes in these cases that are handled by law enforcement and then the prosecuting agencies of the different localities in which the injuries occur. So let's kind of talk about and unpack what that means. Now, as we all know from Law and Order and shows that like that, people can violate and people, I mean staff members of nursing homes or individuals that are taking care of elderly persons, they can violate criminal laws, mm-hmm. criminal codes, right?
Yeah.
You know, don't murder, don't, you know, litter on the ground, things that imply a criminal sentence such as jail time or fines. And mm-hmm. from a general standpoint, those criminal code sections require a level of culpability. Mm-hmm. In the law, we call that mens rea, mm-hmm. That are different depending on what the crime is. Sometimes those crimes require a level of intent. Sometimes these crimes can occur just because the person acted negligently, not necessarily intending the consequences of that particular action. With violations of criminal statutes, that's kind of like I said, like the law and order. You have the police will go, oftentimes the police, sometimes it's other investigative bodies.
Law enforcement in general.
Law enforcement in general will
invest. So everybody from the FBI to the DEA to the ATF to local law enforcement
will investigate.
Yeah.
And bring charges or arrest individuals for violations of those
statutes.
Of criminal statutes. And then depending on whether or not there's evidence that they believe would result in a fair shot at conviction, they'll turn it over to the prosecutorial body of that particular location. That might be the county solicitor, the county DA, might be the state attorney general.
Some could be the AUSA, the federal prosecutor for that district.
Sure. So you have law enforcement putting someone under arrest or charging someone with violation of a criminal statute. Mm-hmm. That gets investigated by that law enforcement body. The evidence gets turned over to an agency represented by the state or the federal government, and that individual gets put on trial. And in trial, a criminal trial works a little bit differently than a civil trial. In the criminal trial, an individual is presumed innocent until proven guilty. And one of the most important facets of our criminal justice system is that individuals are have to be proven guilty by what's called a reasonable doubt, meaning that the state or the federal government or whoever the prosecutorial body is bringing the claim
has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they are guilty of violating that criminal statute.
That the defendant is guilty of violating that. And that's a very high standard.
It's the highest standard that we have. In the civil world, it's different. It's just more likely than not.
Correct. So the conclusion of the criminal of a criminal act or a criminal case would be violation of the criminal statute, investigation and arrest by the law enforcement body, prosecution in the form of a criminal trial by the prosecution, and then that person is found either not guilty or guilty, and they go to jail or they pay a fine, depending on whether or not the sanctions for that criminal act are misdemeanor or felony. So a misdemeanor in most states is going to be punished by a fine, of a certain amount, generally not that much, probably less than $1,000, I think, in most instances, and generally in jail time, not less or not more than a year. That's generally how a misdemeanor works. Mm-hmm. And then you have a felony if the sanctions on that are, if that crime is a felony, then they can have fines much higher than that. And then obviously they can have jail time or even death depending on what the crime was. Yeah. That in a nutshell, in a very, very simple nutshell, is how a criminal trial, a criminal act, a crime prosecuted to its ultimate conclusion would work.
It's probably the most frustrating and debilitating explanation of the criminal justice system that I think any human has ever given. But it could be a police officer, and it could be three police officers that come, and sometimes four police officers. Then what they'll do is they'll take him to the courthouse. The courthouse could be on Baker Street.
So the civil process works in a different way, not too different, but I mean, you know, it follows along the same lines. So an individual normally, and this is how negligence works, and this is, you know, a majority of our cases are negligence. An individual owes what's called a duty of care to every other individual to act like a reasonably prudent person. And that includes nursing home staff. So when a nursing home staff either intentionally or unintentionally does something that causes injury, and that thing that they do that causes the injury is not congruent with the appropriate standard of care of that person, then there is what's called a cause of action, meaning that individual that's injured or their family, depending on the situation, will be able to pursue a claim against the individual or the facility that caused the injury. What happens is that, well, normally you usually don't want to do that by yourself. Usually you will hire a attorney. The attorney will on their own do an investigation. And generally the investigation that an attorney does can include things like ordering medical records, reviewing the statement of deficiencies of a particular facility. It can include looking at videos. It can include hiring a private investigator. There's all kinds of things that an attorney can do that would generate evidence to support a potential claim.
Yeah.
And once the attorney has concluded the investigation, that's generally when one of two things can happen. The attorney can either negotiate with the nursing home, say, hey, listen, you've breached the standard of care causing injury, and you should compensate the injured person by this much. And then a negotiation process may or may not incur. Or a lot of times what happens is all that information, that evidence gets put into a lawsuit document, and a lawsuit gets filed. And that's the civil justice system. So once the lawsuit's filed, then you go through the litigation process with that nursing home or that individual that injured the person. And the burden of proof for that claim is different than it would be in a criminal trial. In a civil trial, the plaintiff must prove their claim by what's called a preponderance of the evidence, meaning that if you take all of the evidence, 100% of the evidence, then at least 51% of that evidence must show that the individual breached that standard of care which caused the injury, which caused damages, by a preponderance of evidence. And so if the plaintiff is successful, if the family of the abused or neglected person is successful, then the individual is not necessarily guilty. They are what's called liable. They are liable to the injured party by whatever amount that a jury has concluded. Those are the main structural differences between the criminal and civil system. So in a standard abuse case, it is not a necessary, I'm sorry, I'm going to move back up. In a standard abuse case, there is not necessarily going to be a criminal component. And the reason why is because oftentimes there is a lack of evidence of the mental culpability, the intent of the party doing the harm. There is a difference between a nursing home staff walking up to a resident and just punching the resident in the face, or intending to do an act for the intention of causing a specific type of injury, mm-hmm. as opposed to we have not been feeding the resident appropriately or providing the appropriate medicine by mistake. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, there's not going to be a criminal component in every case.
Yeah.
And particularly, most often, it's only the most egregious cases in which a criminal case can exist at the same time as a civil case. And that's really the key difference is the level of intent, and the level of harm is what's going to arouse the suspicion of the law enforcement body.
And in the context of long-term care facilities, to the extent that there's ever a criminal component for negligence, it tends to be that there's a fraud component, so that the long-term care facility has been bilking Medicare or Medicaid.
In terms of financial crimes.
Financial crimes. I mean, of course, there's always going to be a criminal component for intentional abuse, simply because there's always anything from simple battery to aggravated assault anytime, you know, you're abusing somebody, or even specific statutes regarding elder abuse, which is... brings us to the case out in where is this, North Carolina?
Right. So, you know, as we were saying, a part of bringing a claim in the civil court or part of bringing charges in a criminal case requires evidence, which in a turn requires somebody being able to identify abuse to begin with.
Right.
And at least one, in my opinion, progressive, I mean, it's ahead of its time, one county in North Carolina, I don't even know if I'm saying this correctly, Alamance County?
I don't know. I've never heard of it.
Alamance County, North Carolina, is developing a training program for, it's been awarded a grant, $350,000 grant, to help train law enforcement officers, prosecutors, judges, victim service providers, and nonprofits in how to better investigate and provide services to elders in need. According to the grant application, 137 sworn officers, which is 37% of this particular county's sworn officers across all agencies, have vowed to attend an 8-hour training, and 21 detectives and investigators across various law enforcement agencies are expected to attend advanced law enforcement training to identify and spot elder abuse. And that's, I think that's very important because, I mean, you know, if you, it's one thing for an attorney to say, I think abuse has happened here, and I think that there is a remedy for you in a civil trial. There's another thing for a informed police officer who has been trained to identify abuse to say, hey, not only that, but you are in violation of a particular criminal code here, right, and we're going to prosecute you.
Yeah.
And we're going to learn, we've learned how to gather the appropriate evidence, take the appropriate pictures, take the appropriate tests, that kind of thing. I think that's an important advancement, and I applaud this particular county for, you know, applying for and getting the funds for the grant and moving forward with this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good step forward.
So I think that hats off to Alamance County. Yeah, I'm sure Alamance. That, you know, hopefully won't get any angry letters ever.
Yeah,
I'm but sure. If they do, I'm sure they will originate from whatever county Alamance that is. County. So I think that's interesting because, you know, at least in Georgia, there are certain, and I'm sure this is the same in many other states, that there mm-hmm. are laws that require and obligate certain individuals to report elder abuse. In Georgia, that law is codified at OCGA 30-5-4. Mandated reporters must make a report when they have reasonable cause to believe that, one, an at-risk adult has had an injury or injuries inflicted upon them by a caretaker, or two, has been neglected or exploited by a caretaker. And mandated reporters can include nursing staff, it can include government officials, but I think that's an interesting component to the law that, you know, not only do you have a duty to take care of people, but some people have a duty right. to report what they see, and that's not necessarily the case for everybody. And this moves us to our next segment, in which we deal with or we talk about new lawsuits that have been filed across the country, mm-hmm. and this actually arises out of events at a convalescent home in Atascadero. Was that
Atascadero?
That's what we decided. That's how you pronounce it.
Atascadero.
Right. Okay. For the second time in a year, an Atascadero-based convalescent hospital has been accused of failing to properly care for one of its elderly patients, resulting in death, according to the lawsuit that was filed in what is that county?
San Luis Obispo.
How do you say that again?
San Luis Obispo.
So you're doing kind of a French. As well as a Spanish.
San Luis?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't major in Spanish like you, so, you know, you would think that you could at least help us out on this avenue.
Well, you know, you have the computer up, so, you know, anyway. So we have here a, according to the lawsuit was filed in San Luis Obispo County with the complaint alleging that the staff was aware that an individual was susceptible to bed sores, but they utterly ignored that resident's needs, causing her to develop painful and infected bed sores. The suit also claims that the staff ignored concern from the family, and her condition rapidly deteriorated. And as the condition worsened, the patient became psychotic and delusional, and eventually had to be rushed to the hospital, where she eventually died. And this is not the first time. The lawsuit marks the second time this particular law firm has sued this convalescent home. In July, the law firm filed suit against the facility in connection with the death of Leo Paul Landry, an elderly man who suffered from dementia. According to the lawsuit, Landry was transferred to the facility in 2014 after hip surgery. He was prone to falls, but the lawsuit charged that the staff disregarded the information and warnings from the family, and he fell several times during his stay. In April of that year, he developed pneumonia. His condition worsened, but instead of taking the appropriate medical steps, the lawsuit alleges that the staff members injected Landry with morphine, and he died shortly thereafter. So that's two very avoidable catastrophes from one facility in the course of a year.
And even the physician for the first lady said that he had seen these types of incidences way too often from these facilities.
Yeah, that's a shame, and we wish the attorney success. We wish the family well for those families that were affected by that particular place. I mean, like, I know that we've talked about this over and over again in this podcast so far. I know this is we're only a few episodes deep into this program, but bed sores are, for the most part, an avoidable problem that leads to serious injury and sometimes death. And it's just a shame that this is happening this often across the country.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And with our most vulnerable citizens too, again, as we've said before.
And with regard to the second incident where morphine was administered, was that common when you were a CNA? I mean, do you often see morphine administered by staff?
Yeah, well, all drugs are administered by the staff. It's either a licensed practical nurse or a registered nurse. The question here, the article doesn't go into it, is whether or not he was prescribed that. If not, there's a whole nother issue there. My guess is that he probably did have an as needed prescription for morphine, and what they did was they gave him the morphine to cover up his pain, and he died from his injuries. He didn't die from the morphine. Mm. But yeah, the staff are the ones that administer all medication.
Mm. Now, I think we have, if the language of the defense attorney is similar to the thoughts and feelings of the facility, then we're going to have another case where you have a facility that's going to be dinged by a jury for how they behave afterwards. So we have
absolutely.
The defense attorney in this case was quoted as saying that between the first lawsuit that was filed, the language that was used in that lawsuit was also used in this lawsuit, and characterized it as a boilerplate language and a boilerplate claim, as in this law firm is basically just, you know, rehashing the same things over and over again. And I just don't think that's a good...
No, because they essentially are, because it is the same... They're constantly making the same mistakes and committing the same negligence.
Yeah. I just, you know... I don't know. I think that that's probably maybe in bad form.
Yeah.
So that's... Again, we wish them luck. And moving into our final segment for this episode, we have... just an egregious case here out of Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin. An assisted living facility in Pleasant Prairie has been ordered to shut down after an employee and former Kenosha County Sheriff's Captain was accused of sexually assaulting a resident. Documents were obtained showing the facility's owner knew of the allegations for some time, but allegedly asked staff not to report it. 73-year-old Clarence Milk, an employee at the facility owned by his wife, was charged with four counts of second-degree sexual assault of a 50-year-old resident who suffers from Huntington's disease. The facility has since been shut down, fined $10,000 in order to relocate its residents. And this is a perfect example of what we talked about earlier in this episode regarding civil liability versus criminal liability.
Yeah. He's definitely facing criminal liability.
Absolutely.
Without a doubt. I mean, certainly rape. And I don't know what the different laws are in Wisconsin as related to elder abuse, but he's facing some pretty serious felonies.
Serious felonies.
And his wife, you know, for not reporting it on her part, actually could be open to criminal liability as well, but certainly negligence.
Absolutely.
Failure to prevent this kind of thing from happening, or failure to report it.
And, you know, just for those out there that have loved ones in long-term care facilities, with regards to sexual abuse, what are some signs and symptoms that they should be looking out for?
You know, being withdrawn, if their personalities suddenly changes, I would say really the same type that you would look for in anybody else. They don't want to be touched. They draw in on themselves. But sometimes that's hard to tell because some of these individuals have, you know, mental incapacities, and they can't really express what's going on, and they could be sexually abused by other residents. And that is something that is a huge concern, and it does occur. It occurs from, you know, we talked about the resident who killed that woman and no charges were filed. It occurs when other residents intentionally commit sexual assault, and it occurs when other residents simply don't know what they're doing. And so, you know, the best thing you can do is just ask the staff, like, hey, are you guys having any issues? It tends to be, by and large, the male residents as the aggressors. That is not always the case. That is definitely not always the case. But just ask the staff, you know, what's going on, guys? And you need to get to know the staff anyway. You need to go up there often. You need to talk with the staff, be very polite, be courteous. You know, you catch more flies with honey than you do vinegar. And so the staff will tell you, like, oh, yeah, we're having issues with this guy. We're having issues, you know, with this individual.
And that's with regard to when you may or may not suspect that it's another resident of the facility that's doing the sexual abuse as opposed to the staff.
Yeah, I mean, by and large, it's not going to be the staff. Sometimes it is. You know, there's always a wide variety of individuals out there with strange proclivities. And sometimes you can have individuals in nursing homes who are not elderly. You can have people who have Huntington's disease or MS or other ailments. I've taken care of women as young as mid-40s. I mean, that's not necessarily somebody.
No, I get your point. Yeah, exactly.
Grandmother. And so it happens. But it also, you know, it's hard to look out for in individuals that can't vocalize what's going on.
Sure. So just, again, at the end of the day, you know, you want to visit often, be mindful, ask questions with the staff, get to know the staff, try to notice observable physical signs like bruising, rashes, red marks around the genitals, that kind of thing. And then, you know, just be alert and be vigilant. Those are some of the best ways to ward off sexual abuse, sexual assault in a nursing home, long-term care facility situation. And on that note, I think that we have reached the conclusion to this particular episode. Again, this is a video podcast, meaning that you are able to consume it in either way you like. You can either listen by downloading the audio version of the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, or you can watch on YouTube. And with that, we will see you next time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. Please be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And feel free to leave us some feedback. And for more information about the topics discussed in this episode, check out the show website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. That's nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. See you next time.